Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, welcome everyone. Today's episode is going to be with provider attorney Debbie Rothman out of Pennsylvania. And it's a wide-ranging conversation, but we do stay pretty focused on one major theme, which is that she offers a lot of flat rates, pay-as-you-go, flat rates for specific tasks, flat rates for certain appearances. And this makes it a lot more affordable for the average human being, people that are filing in family court or estate planning, to be able to afford her, because she doesn't have to ask for $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 up front. She kind of breaks things up. So we really do dive deep into, all the mechanics of how to offer flat rates and, the way she thinks about it, how it works for her, how it allows her just to focus on serving her clients and not worry about the clock, not have to bill for every hour and these types of things. So there's certainly a lot of benefits to it. There's, certain things you have to do to, certainly make sure you're not, overdoing it or going broke, and quoting the right flat fees and so forth. So we talk about all those different considerations. So it's an excellent interview, and she's been doing extremely well with the leads for quite some time. So we hope you enjoy it. So with that, let's get right into it. This interview with Debbie Rothman, one of our provider attorneys out of Delaware County, Pennsylvania. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm really glad we're getting a chance to chat today. And just before we started in here, we were having a kind of a lively discussion about technology and kind of how it's impacting the law profession and allowing you to make it easier for clients to work with you and interface with and get you the documents you need faster and communication channels faster. So it's going to be really interesting to dive into some of the things that you've seen unfolding in your arena and how it's been impacting the way you've working with your clients. But maybe before we jump into that, maybe you could give just a little background on how you got started in the practice of law, the region you serve, and what you focus on in your practice.
All right, I'd be happy to. I've been practicing law primarily in the Delaware County, Pennsylvania area, which is a suburb out of Philadelphia. And it's called the five-county area around Philadelphia. In that area for about 21 years as a sole practitioner. I had a brief period with a law firm as well. My background, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska originally, and wended my way out to Syracuse University to go to law school and get my MBA because with Omaha geography, I thought I'd be able to get in to see Broadway shows. It didn't work out that way since Syracuse is about 5 hours away from Broadway, but I did enjoy my time there. And then I began, my first job out of law school was as a vice president of an insurance company in upstate New York. And I did a lot of work on the corporate end of things. A lot of lobbying and a lot of issues research and some internal company department management as well. I was there for several years and then I went on to KPMG Pete Marwick and the consulting industry. And I was there for a few years and then my partners at the time, they sort of disbanded his division. So I was let go in a mid-management layoff at that time. At that point, I was the mother of a 1.5-year-old. I had a license in New York State and a license in Connecticut where I had sat for those bars, but I found myself in Pennsylvania having worked on there for Pete Marwick, and I didn't have a job. And as as things are wont to do, my domestic situation disappeared somewhat as my money disappeared, and I had to figure out a way to solve my dilemma. So my parents, God bless them, had always said, way from the back, go be a lawyer, you can always work for yourself. Nobody's going to let you go from a job. And so I said, you know what? I guess I'm going to start because it was like a white collar recession at the time. It was probably the mid 90s. And I had a lot of interviews with people who said, you're lovely, you're qualified for very rarefied things, and you make too much money. We can't accommodate you. Well, I did make too much money in the past, but at that point I was making no money. So that became a difficult obstacle. So I found out about a little room that was for rent for like $90 a month. Somebody said, well, you can go be a lawyer in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. And I'm like, I had flown around on jets and been a corporate muckety muck, so I thought. And I had never walked into a courtroom and entered my appearance or filed something in a clerk's office. I had not a clue how to do this. And I just had to roll up my sleeves and ask a lot of questions, be very humble, and let myself get taught by a community of lawyers how to begin to be a lawyer. So that was about 21 years ago. And now, in those 21 years, I've practiced a lot of family law and a lot of criminal law. And I got into criminal law because my county had court-appointed positions available widely through the community. You didn't need all that much experience. And I learned a lot from doing that. And family law, I've also done since the beginning. And now I've added in estate work through Unbundled, which I really am finding to be very, very interesting. In fact, I had my first litigation today in the state law from an Unbundled case, and I won against Dilworth Paxson, which is not an insignificant law firm out east. So I had fun. It was an interesting day. So that's where I am. That's who I am, and I'm practicing with Unbundled through several counties in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and what is it that you've liked? And there's a couple of things you shared there I'd love to dive into. But what is it that you've liked so much about the estate law and as you've started taking those clients through Unbundled Attorney?
It's new to me. It's like I'm one of these people that constantly has to have something, you know, something new to sort of encounter and overcome and get confidence at. It always scares me to death. And I ask 100 questions of 100 people. Am I doing it right? Is my instinct right? Is this the correct way? And usually it almost, you know, gets reinforced that I did it fine, but I still always check. And it's a new thing. It's nice to have, it's good to keep yourself challenged. And otherwise I tend to get bored. And when you get bored, you don't get enjoyment out of what you're doing.
Right. Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, throughout your career, you've kind of started from the ground, you know, from a standpoints of, you know, not very much experience, not a ton of confidence, and had to self-teach or, you know, learn from experience and from others to kind of work your way up to a point of competence. Kind of looking back on it, maybe for example, for attorneys that are new to a practice area or new to a specific region or something like that, you know, if you look back on it, what was it for you that, you know, helped you kind of get through those times and really kind of overcome areas where maybe you had a little bit of insecurity or uncertainty about, you know, what you were doing and so forth, but kind of allowed you to bridge that gap and get to the next step?
Well, I didn't really work for anyone. As I said, I was always pretty much on my own. But I found, whether by luck or by, I'm not really sure how this happened, but I found a community. I would urge any attorney who's stepping out from their comfort zone, whether they were in a career where they didn't practice, use their license to practice law, to step out and to find a community. You know, go to the bar association functions or, I was rather lucky. My situation may not be so easily replicated. My first preliminary hearing in one of the local district courts on a criminal case one day, these two middle-aged gentlemen, I was a new face in town, and they came up and they said, hi, you know, and they introduced themselves, and they both invited me to join a table that had lunch, had lunch at the same table in the same restaurant for decades, really. And I was the first female who had ever started attending this table regularly. One of the gentlemen, it took him 5 years to say hello to me. I was at the table eating lunch with them, but he wouldn't talk to me because I was like a female interloper of this little bastion. That changed over time. I learned how to talk a lot about golf and baseball and have a thick skin. And between all of that, though, these gentlemen, though, helped me a great deal. I could come to the table frustrated, angry, concerned, and I could put out the facts, and they would talk about the facts with me and give me some good advice, and taught me not to have too thin of a skin ever, and, you know, live to fight another day. You know, very, very important types of things for a young lawyer in litigation, in sole practice to learn. So these people, and who are still dear friends, the table changed, the restaurant closed. Some people are deceased, some people retired or moved away, but there's still some little nucleus. And after me came a few other younger lawyers, and I'm no longer what I would even vaguely call a younger lawyer, but that's what lifts you up. You need to have people to talk to, and you can't go home and dump it on your family because they don't care about the details of your procedural argument with some judge or, you know, the difficulty you have with some client. So having those peers, I say, is really critical, at least for me, that social support.
Right. Yeah. Having that support system that, you know, and this is kind of an old, kind of an older way of doing, learning new trades that seems to, you know, have kind of gotten lost in the modern era, but is the kind of the apprenticeship mentorship model where you can kind of develop a level of mastery by working, you know, in cooperation with those around you or through someone that has that level of experience. And, you know,
yeah,
some lawyers
true.
Get that through working within firms, but, you know, and you were able to do it through, you know, getting guidance from those around you that, that, you know, could offer insight. So, you know, it seems like it makes a lot of sense, and it would be very good guidance to really connect to a community, like you said, so that you can get these types of mentors and really fast forward your learning.
Yes, and I it's also relying on the kindness of strangers. I recall early on in the court-appointed criminal defense world, there was a particular public defender who had been there a long, long time, who was the lead public defender in that particular trial room. He was so kind to me, and I will remember it forever, because that kindness, that, you know, I'll give you the answer. No, it's not stupid to ask this question. You know, I'll help you learn how to do this. But no, this is where the forms are kept. You know, that was a great benefit too. So find the people who want to pass the information on and want to help, and they're out there.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. And so let's fast forward a bit. So you've been doing family law for quite some time. Maybe where we could start kind of in the present day is, you know, I know when you first got started with Unbundled Attorney, we were kind of exploring the various different regions that you were going to serve and kind of figuring out, you know, what was too far, what was too close, what are the regions that really, you know, are the areas that, you know, are kind of in your wheelhouse, or at least are you most comfortable working with and are not maybe too far and so forth. But so since then, you know, how things have been going, maybe kind of give a little bit of context on the amount of clients you receive maybe on a monthly basis, how many of those typically become clients, and then maybe we can dive a little bit into your process and how you've the process you've developed, you know, working leads over the last number of months. I guess you've been working together for quite some time now, so and how it's been going.
Well, it's a work in process. Can you hear me still?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, it faded out a little there for me. I'm a vigorous traveler. I will go to courts as far as 3.5, 4 hours away on a fairly regular basis. I remember listening to one of, either Graham told me or it was a podcast, you had a Colorado lady who would travel, you know, many, many hours across the state well.
Missouri. Was it Marcia Stiles?
No, I think it was a woman. I think it was Colorado, actually, the one I recall. But in any case, there are these people.
Okay, sure.
I haven't gone further than about 4 hours of driving, which is a day. I mean, 4 hours in a day and doing your court is quite a day. I've gotten comfortable in a couple of these courts, one of them being Northampton County in Pennsylvania, which is, you know, a bit north of my home county where my office is, and quite a bit farther from my actual home. So it's a haul. But I enjoy, one of the things I really enjoy about Unbundled, and it forces me out of my comfort zone into places I don't know. And now, guess what? They know me now. You know, I can walk down a hall in Northampton County and the one master, a custody master, knows my name and knows me well. And, you know, and she saw me once, two or three times in a week. And she said, my God, you've infiltrated us. You're taking over. So it's something I'm enjoying that. It's also, again, really hard because you have to learn new procedures. You don't know the clerks in the back. You don't know the way the things are handled. And county practice in Pennsylvania is terribly, terribly locally specific. And, you know, some of the bars are very, protective of their local attorneys and can get kind of hostile when you're not one of their local attorneys. But I'm willing to go about the 4-hour range. I have about 30 leads, I would guess, per month coming from you in the jurisdictions that I have signed up for. It varies what the closing rate and what it comes and goes. I mean, most of the people want to be represented, but some of the people, the reality of it just isn't there yet. They have to wait several months. I hear from them much, much later. Mm-hmm. I had one, there's cases, of course, need incredible babysitting and all kinds of time investment that for very little money. And I have one of those cases, a custody case now, where it has gotten so horrific with the communications that we got the couple on software so we can actually track the communications between them because there's no way to make sense of it all. And she's paying me, I don't know, $100, $200 a month, nowhere near what it would take to handle this barrage of communications between these two, but the technology may help shortcut that. To the client whose father paid me a very nice retainer to just be there in case his daughter ever wanted to talk to me, and I think she called once. So there's a wide range of utilization of the services, and on a flat fee, you know, we as the attorney are bearing the risk. Of bearing the risk of what that can turn into, and then also need to have the skill to manage it so that we're not getting way out of control where that flat fee, you know, what we're actually giving away for that flat fee is not too much.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not every one of the attorneys you work in the network offers the flat rates model. Some of them do more of hourly or certain hours by the hour kind of thing. But yours, you know, if my understanding is you do offer some flat rates for specific tasks and for the specific case. So maybe can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you work with flat rates and, you know, if it pertains to the task, sometimes to a whole case or, you know, and how that's been going so far?
Well, quite frankly, I was an unbundled attorney before I was an unbundled attorney. I have always, as I think many of us do, absolutely loathe hourly billing and charting every phone call. And I often get lost in the facts and the situation. I want to pay attention to my client and their story and their needs, not, you know, okay, this is 45 minutes and I'm not going to get paid for it and blah, blah, blah. I just don't want to think about the clock that way. I have a more holistic approach to my clients and their cases. So I started doing flat fees a while ago. Maybe a couple of years because I've been practicing so long that I was pretty confident that I knew what a majority of the cases would take to get done. So I could do a gut quote and have it be a fairly accurate assessment. So, you know, now at this point we charge by the pleading or by the hearing and it's the same rate. I charge $750 a pleading, $750 a hearing. If it's not a full trial, if it's just a simple, you know, if it's a custody hearing, sometimes they aren't so simple, but a custody hearing or support hearing, master level, or a contempt hearing, if it's a trial, a full-on custody trial, it's a different set of fees. But those initial phases leading up to the trial stage, $750, and if it's one of those 3 or 4 hour away, jurisdictions, I may add a $50 traveling fee to cover my gas and tolls. And that's pretty much how I do it. People like it because it's knowable. They don't have that open-ended fear of, oh my God, what's going to be at the end of this? And I don't drop them along the way if they run out of money. I mean, if you've paid for $750 for me to be at a hearing on July 15th, I'm there and I do the job. And
right.
That's kind of a comfort to everybody. I know, and sometimes it takes me 4 hours and sometimes it takes me 20 minutes. And I tell the clients that. I said, listen, I bear the risk of this. You don't. But then you don't bear the risk of an open-ended hourly fee that could end up being $3,000 for that day. And they
right.
seem to understand that.
Right. And every state's a little different here, so I'm just a little bit curious. Certain states, you know, allow you to file a notice of a limited appearance, and then you go in, and then you're basically automatically withdrawn. Other times you can do limited appearances. Other times certain states don't allow limited appearances at all, like, you know, I think Texas and a couple other states are that way. When you're doing the kind of flat rate hearing, is that a flat rate even if it gets postponed or something like that, or is this actually considered a limited appearance, and how do you kind of contract that when you have the possibility that sometimes these things could get, you know, dragged out and so forth?
Well, it sort of depends on the art of knowing when to file your entry of appearance. In Delaware County, for instance, if you show up for somebody's support modification hearing, for instance, and it's relisted, as they almost invariably are, for a later date for various terms to be met or data to be gathered. If they don't want to pay me for that next hearing, because usually to get to the this is what we're going to do relisted stage, you've gone through a hearing to get there. If it's just a continuance, like a flat out continuance, like the master was sick and it's just a new date, I don't charge people for those. I don't think that's fair. It's just my way. I'll just come back again if it's something that's like administrative. But if I have a hearing first, so you have a hearing and it's relisted, I go, you know, it's another fee for the next relist. We don't really use that term limited appearance here. Now, once you get, let's say, to the let's say the master's finding is one of the parties doesn't like it and they appeal it to have a de novo hearing in front of a judge. And I enter my appearance on that case. Now, then I'm not just going to quite as easily be able to drop out if it doesn't work out with if I don't get paid or I don't get paid the amount that is appropriate or they agreed to. Then you have to petition the court, and they're getting, in this area, they're getting a little bit stingy about more than they used to be. You used to just not be able to show up, frankly. It was very, very loose. But now they're sort of tightening up on family law lawyers, more like they are in the realm of criminal law lawyers have always been, that you don't just get out because you're not paid. So that's how you have to ask the court, and sometimes they'll just say, no, you're in. The money's your problem.
Right. Okay. Awesome. And I really get where you're coming from with regard to the flat rates, as far as how you really just want to be solely focused on your client, not thinking about, you know, how much the clock has gone by, if it's going to pay, you're getting paid or not, or it's just kind of, you can just focus on doing what needs to be done for that client from that moment forward, you know, and that I can see that, you know, really allows you just to be there and be focused on what needs to get done. Can you talk a little bit about the cost benefit analysis, about how flat rate billing has worked for you? You know, where, you know, some cases maybe you can get them out the door for an hour or two, and then your effective hourly rate ends up being, you know, $300-$400, but then other cases they take longer than expected. How has that generally worked for you relative to perhaps, you know, just billing hour by hour, like some other attorneys, you know, for example, for attorneys that only have done hour by hour and might be considering doing flat rate, and how that kind of pencils out?
Well, my problem is, if I want to go hour by hour, I have to have that old fashioned retainer up front. What are you going to bill from? You need $2,000, $2,500. If you bill by the hour and you only have a $750 amount on retainer, usually hourly rates are, if you're going to be at all, you can't bill at $100 an hour. I mean, you're billing it whatever you are, $275, $325, $350, whatever your particular locality is. And those smaller amounts tend to get eaten up. I don't know. It just seems like they get eaten up faster. I don't know if I'm more efficient when I'm doing it on a flat rate, but I just feel that I'm satisfied personally with the amount that I'm receiving. If it's a little more complex of a matter, I will take a bigger flat fee if it senses that there's going to be more issues. The per hour has really never been something I liked, never been something I really dealt with comfortably. So I don't know if I can compare it to that because I don't really do it anymore and I haven't done it for years.
Hmm. Right. And I really like the word that you said, you know, the efficiency. It's like you find you're more efficient. And in a sense, when you're doing flat rates, knowing that, you know, you're getting paid by the job or by the task, it kind of puts you in a frame of mind as far as, you know, what aspects of what I'm doing are redundant. What aspects of these
right.
systems can be automated or streamlined? Or, you know,
right.
if I'm doing the same thing multiple times, how can we find a way to do this over and over? So it almost kind of breeds a certain refinement of your practice, does it not?
And a more plain language way of saying it puts fire under you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're comfortable billing away by the hour off some fat retainer, there's no incentive really, you know, to get better because your client's taking up the slack. They're paying for it.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, that can kind of segue into, you know, what we were talking about earlier as far as technology and ways you can kind of streamline that. But before we kind of do that, one of the things, obviously, that's a major benefit, it seems to me, of offering this type of flat rate, you could almost call it kind of pay as you go in a way where it's like phase one is this, phase two is this, and you pay for each phase as you go, is that a lot of clients don't have to come up with so much up front. And certainly from a lead generation model where you're not getting a third-party referral and it's someone that maybe hasn't met you before, that having that cost barrier be lower and more accessible, has that, you know, helped with your ability to have more clients kind of get started in the process because they don't have to come up with that huge amount up front?
Absolutely. And one of the things I like about it is that even though it may not sound like a lot of money to have $150 or $200 a month, if you get enough of those, you have a cash flow. One of the problems with being a sole practitioner is you can have an influx of a big retainer, and then there can be a drought for a while. Or, you know, you can't really modulate an average cash flow. But when you have a lot of little clients, each paying those small amounts throughout the month, it kind of evens things out. And it also makes you know what you can expect in the coming week for budgeting, the coming 2 weeks, the coming month, as opposed to, you know, just keeping your fingers crossed that the phone's going to ring and there's going to be another client coming in.
Right. Yeah, you know, knowing that all your bills are kind of covered with your base level expenses is something that, you know, Bob Ivanko out of Connecticut talked a lot about. It's just, he just knows. And when you have those kind of ups and downs, or, you know, he gave an example of, you know, he had some, you know, family and medical emergencies and so forth. And, you know, he just knew that the office was going to close down. You know, he could weather the storms because those plans were in place with clients that he was actively serving. Even if he's only putting an hour or two a time, you know, into each case, he just knows that income's coming in no matter what. And you know, he talked about the security that gave him and his ability to run a consistent practice over time, no matter what happens.
Yes, I still, that $100 that someone sends in pays, you know, fills the gas tank, pays a bill, and it's good that it's there. I'm never ungrateful for a payment.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of alluded or mentioned the fact that you kind of do sometimes like a payment plan over time on the flat rates. Can you talk about
yes.
kind of how that works usually? And is that in the scenario where I guess someone may not have the full 750, or maybe if it's a little bit higher level case, you know, how you've been able to structure that and how you kind of figure out how much to charge. And obviously it's going to have a lot to do with the person's budget, but you know, certainly there's going to be certain constraints around how much work you know needs to get done each month and making sure you don't fall too far behind. So how have you figured out how to balance that out?
Well, I have a couple of clients that leap to mind that I've dealt with in the last few months. One was a client who was in South Carolina and had a custody case. I believe this predates you. My relationship with Unbundled, I don't really remember how I originally ended up with him. But he had a custody trial up here and several listings before we got to the trial state. So it was a several thousand dollar bill at the end of the day. And he has paid me $200 to $300 every 24th of the month for months and months and months and months. And, you know, he's good for it. You know, part of this is doing a little bit of underwriting. You know, you have to have a sense of who your client is. I've certainly gotten burned by people many, many, many times in the past over 21 years of practice. But if you do have a good feel for them, and I have another client as well who currently, he was an Unbundled client, came to me. Initially when he came to me, he didn't have any money and he didn't hire me. Ended up with a PFA against him that has come back to haunt him that I couldn't undo, but I've represented him in the custody aspects ever since. And he pays me every 2 weeks on the 15th and the 30th, the same type of thing. So I have found those bigger cases, and his bill has been probably a total of $7,000 or $8,000 in the last few months. So, but he reliably pays away. So those are the types of cases that work out very, very well. Now some of these other cases where it's 100, you know, 150, those are that sometimes there's some bit of a nuisance quality to some of these. They hang on too long and the payments go out too far. But as long as they're making them, I have one client that's paying $50 every month. Their case is over. I did it. And there's a few $100 left, maybe $300, $400, $500. It'll be taken care of through the course of the year. So I found them to be, you know, if I have a good sense of these people, I can let them do these payment plans.
Yep. Right. So it really comes down to kind of your gut feeling about the type of person that you're dealing with, their ability to make good, and then you can kind of be flexible once you have a certain degree of confidence in their ability to be consistent with that.
And you have to be very careful because there's a lot of people who you know, talk a good game and then vanish. You know, the lawyer's always the last one on the list that anybody wants to pay.
Which is ironic too, because you might be the one responsible for all the time that they're spending with their kid that's now costing him all that money. But so quick to forget that it was your role that made all that time happen, you know?
I don't even know. Some of the people think they, once it's over, it's like, well, I could have done that. Well, no, you couldn't have. But some people don't mean to put you at the bottom of the list. It's just that life happens and because, you know, what are we really going to do to them? Now, I don't sue people. What am I going to sue you for, $750?
Right.
I'm not in the business of suing clients, or I'd be busy with that. Collection agencies have little or no effectiveness. If they're going to pay you, they're going to pay you.
Right. Yep, I agree. And, you know, on the flip side of that, I mean, you've got, you know, I'm sure a whole host of number of more clients, you know, paying on a monthly basis and that you're able to work for and deliver services for and help out, that, you know, a lot of other attorneys might turn away. And I'm sure, many clients
everybody.
Are really grateful for that.
I have many people who say, every lawyer I called said they needed thousands of dollars up front, you know, and I got one from you guys this week who's going to go do a craft show over the weekend to try to raise the fee for me to show up at her hearing on July 11th. Because I said I would just let her hire me for July 11th. And every other lawyer she talked to wanted thousands. And she's desperate to have somebody to help her get her kids. So, yes, very much. I give Pete in a lot of gratitude, too.
Yeah, sounds like it. Absolutely. I really appreciate that about you, Debbie, that you really find creative ways to work with folks. You have a good sense for people that, you know, that you can work for, and your willingness to offer these types of creative flat rates, lower starting fees, payment plans, and the way that you do, you know, really just makes a huge difference. And this is, you know, what this is really all about. You know, this unbundled attorney, this whole project is about, you know, working with attorneys such as yourself that are finding ways to serve the clients that are going underserved in this country. And it just so happens to be the majority of the marketplace. Unfortunately, you know, in the last 10 years, we've had a complete flip in the amount of folks that are going underrepresented now. And so, you know, being able to offer these options in a way that also, you know, is profitable too. You know, you guys, you're in the business to make money. It's not a charity. And you've been able to be successful at that too, finding that balance with working the right amount of clients, but then being able to offer these types of flexible options where you can make money and you can serve the people at the same time. And, you know, you're a perfect example of that, you know, done successfully.
I can't tell you how many times I've said to people after their story, you know, I said, I'm very reasonable and I'm very flexible, but I'm not free. I'm not legal aid. And they get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that middle ground. You know, it's not the $5,000 upfront or, you know, nothing. It's not the, you know, legal aid. It's the working families, you know, blue collar, you know, people that are lower middle income families that are, you know, like $500 out of every check can hurt, you know, can make a difference. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a way to bridge that gap by using these options like we're talking about, flat rate billing, payment plans, unbundled services, delivering tasks, splitting up the workload between the client and yourself. I mean, this is what, you know, this is all about, what this podcast is about, the company and so forth. So it's really really enlightening to kind of hear, you know, how the flat rate model isn't working for you and the way you've been able to tailor that to the clients. And so on that thread, as far as the flat rates, and given that you're kind of it rewards a movement towards efficiency, have there been some technologies or tools or things that you've developed over the years? You know, I think maybe you can talk a little bit about the support staff, your paralegal that you work with, and you know, how have you been able to kind of craft a more streamlined approach, either from the tech side or from your support staff side, to make sure that you're getting these tasks done in the most efficient way manner under these flat rates?
Well, I have to admit, in my corporate years, I was a very spoiled person. I had a full-time secretary who, you know, who paid my personal bills as well as, you know, handled my business life. And when I started working for myself, I also had a secretary right from the get-go, even though I really absolutely couldn't afford one. But I wasn't really sure how to operate outside that old-fashioned framework, if you will, of, you know, here, you handle this. I've begun it, you finish it. And I have changed over the years. As I said right before we got on the podcast here, I said my legal career has spanned the dawn of fax machines through what typewriters and leading to word processors through all this new leading edge technology that I haven't even quite gotten all to. I mean, law office management programs that we were discussing, you gave me the link for that podcast. I'm going to look into that because I haven't really advanced myself to that thinking because I kept thinking, well, I'm just a sole practitioner. What does law office management sound so much bigger? But it seems it really isn't. It's about getting the efficiency of my sole practice to a higher state. So I am going to look into that. I told you I had just been coming across in all the masters, in one master's office, and then with from another colleague, these various programs, at least three types of software for custody cases that deal with documenting communications and activities of kids, calendars, and communications between couples in conflict, co-parenting, divorced couples or separated couples who just are having all kinds of difficulty making things work. And those programs look like they'll offer a wealth of time saving. I was describing to you how you previously, with the dawn of social media, would have to wander into a courtroom with, you know, three inches of text messages printed out or Facebook threads and then try to present, shuffle through and find the relevant pieces, and or the other side does and you object because it's out of context and the three things before it that would explain it better or after were left out. This software now allows these parties to communicate where it's all in one place. You see the time it was written, the time it was sent, the time it was opened and read by the other party. Its lawyers can look in on this, and certain that information is only available to the lawyers, the time it was read, et cetera. These sorts of things, I think, are just a huge improvement. And I'm looking into adding more software into my practice, which will update me from my old ways.
Yeah, it's starting to streamline. What is the name of the software that allows you to kind of keep track of conversations between two parents?
I think it was called Talking Parents. I actually don't have the exact title. Maybe we can Google that real quickly and get it before I get off the phone. But it's just something I started one couple on at the suggestion of, yeah, it's called Talking Parents, talkingparents.com.
Yep,
it replaces it. Email, text, and other electronic messages between co-parents. So this is a very, it looks to be a very useful program.
Yes.
There's also some other ones. There's time management ones with parents that I'm blanking out as well. But I haven't used them yet. I had clients use them, but it's been suggested by one of the masters. And it calendars the kids' activities, the parents' vacations, work schedules, everything, and allows them to communicate that way. And again, all of the output from these programs is then usable in court, in litigation, in a reasonable, clear manner. I had a case where I was on the other side on a PFA contempt, where the other side, she was unrepresented, but she was organized. And she walked in with, I don't know, 2 inches of texts and emails, all and various highlighters and different colors and cross tabs, and then she was using that as her evidence to support her claim for contempt against my client. So she plops this on my desk because I have to see it. So I start reading it. Well, the judge had no patience. She wanted to go to lunch. She was like, she said, "Are you going to read every one of those?" I said, "Well, I certainly am, Your Honor. These are copies of things. They're marked up. If she's going to use these and ask these to be entered into evidence, I have to read them." And she said, "Let me see those." And the judge took them, snatched them practically, and then, you know, sort of basically read the other woman the riot act. She said, "Well, the attorney's correct. She has the right to the originals on these, not color-coded, you know, snipped up, whatever you've done here, organized the way you like it. And either you reach this agreement that here today, or we're going to come back to court and have a full day trial on this." And, you know, she sort of bullied the other side into altering the custody agreement and dropping the PFA contempt, which would have been a huge problem because there's, you know, jail's a penalty on a PFA contempt if a judge cares to do it. So this sort of programming would allow that kind of situation. In that case, it was good for me that she didn't know what she was doing. But on my side, when I go into court, I can have it prepared so the judge doesn't like fall off the chair because they're going to have to, you know, sift their way through all of this communication between the parties. I think they're really great programs that are going to help me.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it saves a lot of time from a research organization, you know, getting the case together on both sides, and even for the pro se litigant to be able to, I don't know, who knows if they're actually going to be using this type of thing, probably not, but certainly from your standpoint, to be able to, you know, have this evidence, you know, very, you know, just, I mean, and when it's done, do you just kind of print out the communications and then you can kind of just tab it from there and it's like the whole thing start to finish?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally see how that would be.
Yes. I'm very pleased at that prospect of not hauling in 3 copies of 4 pounds of text to court.
Yep. And then maybe you could talk just a little bit about Mike and kind of how you guys have worked together as a team to, you know, deliver the tasks on these flat rates in a more efficient manner to, and kind of moved in a direction of efficiency together.
Well, I have a little bit of a lead on other people hiring people because he happens to be my son. He's in college, and he one day said to me that he no longer wanted to work at the pharmacy, at the drugstore chain that he worked at minimum wage on his feet for his part-time job. He said, you know, I've been around your courts and your office my whole life. Why don't I help you? And I first was sort of, really? Rather surprised. But as it has turned out, it's worked out very well. And I, as I said, when I started, I had a secretary, but I sort of phased that out. I stopped having a secretary several years ago. I've done a lot more of everything myself, but now that the practice is pretty busy right now, we have like 60 to 70 open cases active at the moment. I need somebody there to deal with some of the administrative aspects of it, get those filings done, get those cover letters out, get the copying done, help draft some of those early level pleadings, which he is, you know, quite proficient at. So he's working, I don't know, 20 hours a week perhaps, and it's very helpful. So I have a part-time paralegal / administrative office help. And, you know, because he's my son, I don't necessarily have to pay the market rate, but it's working out well for both of us.
Is that some form of child labor?
Well, he's 22, so I don't think he qualifies as a child anymore.
I know, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
But, my 10-year-old, I haven't dragged in yet.
Paid in ice cream and restaurant dues. No, I'm sure you guys have a good relationship.
He gets good lunches, that's for sure. Mommy, yeah, his boss pays his lunches, that's right.
Right.
So that's what we know. It's just a small office. I'm about to take on an intern, I believe, from a local college as well, to try to fill in the holes. They work for nothing, and we have a lot of liberal arts colleges all around here that are dying to send people out to get some experience. So that one of my colleagues has had a lot of those interns in quite successfully. So I told her to send me the stack of resumes left that she didn't hire, and I'll look through them and speak to them.
Right. You know, because, you know, being able to have that kind of support staff to help you with some of the drafting, the preparation, these types of things, especially when you're working on a flat rate model where, you know, that supports person's, you know, hourly rate that you might be paying them is, you know, certainly significantly less than what you're charging, you know, especially when you're doing a flat rate. I mean, it sounds like, to me like, you know, having that kind of support really makes sense financially to be able to kind of leverage your time and get these things done faster and quicker so that your effective hourly rate becomes much higher.
It's critical, actually. I couldn't have a $50,000 paralegal in here, you know, and be charging $750. It just wouldn't. The math doesn't work at this point. So, yes, you have to push it down.
Right. You know, kind of like grow your staff as your practice grows in kind of complementary fashion to make sure
I really
that
think these interns, now the downside of the interns is you have to spend the time to show them things. But, you know, if you're not paying them, if I'm getting it for credit or the very minimal amount you're paying them, it's definitely worth the value added that they can give you during the period of time they're with you, 6 months, whatever it is. You know, stuff can get done. It pushes that paper and those tasks out the door. Another set of hands. And I think that that's a invaluable as well to keep the cost down.
Right. Okay. Well, this has been just, you know, a wonderful, enjoyable conversation, very useful, you know, on many levels, especially the way in which you've been working with folks and offering these flat rates and finding, you know, just creative ways to work within in people's budgets. Is there anything maybe last, maybe that you've learned in the, over the course of working with us, fielding leads or offering these types of flat rates, you know, one last kind of perspective that you felt you've either developed over the time of fielding the leads or just developed over time that you found it to be critical or maybe was a mistake you made early on that's made the difference for you in being able to be effective at, you know, working with people in the way that you do?
Well, I think I learned that, you know, right away I learned you got to jump on the leads when you get them. You got to text them, call them, write them, you know, if there were carrier pigeons that weren't extinct, send those. You know, you got to get them to you because after a few days, people sometimes change their minds. They decide they don't want to do it anymore. They chicken out or they find other counsels or just lose interest. So that one I learned pretty quickly. I know that Graham had always said to me, you know, if you can't get him on the phone, when he first started, he would say, okay, we're having leads you get this week. Who answered? You know, who to get a hold of and try to get a bead on if I was getting a good closure rate or not. And he'd say text them and call them and email them. Do all three. And sometimes they would respond to one of them and not the other two. So, you know, that's probably really critical. Don't let them linger. The other thing is I'm still a bit of a person, you know, a lot of us lawyers went to school for that quote, we wanted to help the world reason. And yes, we're a business and yes, that's how I support my family. But the unbundled people, again, that gratitude and that eagerness to, they're just thrilled to have a lawyer and a lawyer who they feel is capable of representing them appropriately. And I just think that the importance of that can't be overlooked. And that's why I like what you're doing. That 90% is an appalling number. There is, I have to tell you, in my county, there's a practice that has just begun, which I don't like, which if there's an entry of appearance for a self-represented party that is required if you're going to file something on your case, let's say the other side filed a modification of custody and you want to respond and represent yourself, you have to file this entry of appearance. But they're charging $50 to have you represent yourself, which to me logically is absolutely nonsensical. Does not seem right. And it's yet another barrier. It's another barrier. It's not even free to represent yourself.
Right.
And so there are so many barriers to these people. So many ways they're told, you know, there's no answer for you. And I think that we can give them an answer. And I think it behooves us, an obligation.
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, this is just one way, you know, that collectively, you know, all the providers that have been on the podcast, all the other attorneys you work with that are doing these just wonderful, wonderfully creative ways to work with folks that makes a difference for so many people, you know, and that's a perfect example of just how many barriers, especially from the financial perspective alone, that there are in this country for the average mother or father to get, you know, orders in place, or someone to get an appropriate state plan, someone to get the documents filed for their right for citizenship or permanent residency. I mean, all these types of issues, you know, that make it so difficult for these folks to be able to, you know, defend their rights and get the orders in place that they need to be able to, you know, parent their kids. And so it's the work that you guys are doing and we're all doing collectively to find ways to creatively work with these folks and offer these options that they can fit in their budgets and do it in a way that also, you know, that you can be profitable too. You know, there's an old myth that, you know, the only, you know, you can't, you know, serve low income families and still make money at the same time. And, you know, from what I'm hearing, you're still doing pretty good, aren't you, Debbie?
I'm pleased with it. And it seems to be going all in the right direction.
Yeah.
And
so I think it's not even just the leads or our service. It's not really about that at all. But just, you know, there's ways in which attorneys like yourself can offer these options to folks that most other firms would turn away because most other firms think, oh, I can't make money on these cases unless I get this amount of money up front. And that's just not true. And some of our attorneys that offer the most creative, flexible, low-cost, unbundled, pay-as-you-go types of options are the ones that are doing – just outstandingly financially relative to other attorneys that are a little bit more stringent on or strict in the ways, in the types of cases and the ways in which they'll work with folks.
I have been questioned by other attorneys. Where are you getting your leads? So they are having some of those other attorneys that are doing more traditional stuff are having trouble finding the people.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's less and less of them. There's more and more lawyers. I think it's something like 40,000 new lawyers every single year coming out of law schools, and there's less and less folks that are there to, you know, to be able to afford them. So it's a competitive market, and offering these options is essential.
Have the lawyer jokes multiplied at the same level as the lawyers? I haven't heard any new ones lately.
Yeah, I don't know. We just looked that up actually just the other day because we were, you know, talking about, you know, kind of these trends in the industry and so forth. But I think that was off Wikipedia or something like that. 40,000 new attorneys every single year. Oh, that's what it was. We were reading about the unemployment rate of new attorneys, and that it used to be something like 80-90% would land a job back in 2006, and nowadays, I think in 2013, it's more like 60 or 65% are actually getting jobs. And so, you know, there's just not as much work out there for, you know, less folks, you know, able to do it in the traditional manner. So it's
and
often
I
just
think
kind of
the young people, I think the new graduates have to, you know, get brave and strike out, and you know, they can find the people. As long as they have that help of that community to, you know, help them through the early parts of it.
Yep. Yeah, it's just it's an adaptation to a new market. So the people are still there. It's just the way in which they need to be served has been evolving. And that's no way more evident than the way you've been working with folks. And so I just want to thank you for, you know, all the work you're doing. And I know it's making a lot of difference for the people that we've been sending you. And we appreciate the creativity and the amount of service and compassion you've been bringing in your practice to all the folks we've sent you. So thanks again for everything you've been doing.
Well, thanks for calling me today. I was pleased to be invited.
Absolutely. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up for today. And for everyone else that's been listening to the podcast, we appreciate you as well. If you're enjoying the podcast, give us your feedback by leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And you know, feel free to share it with any other attorneys or anyone else you know that would benefit. You know, this is a kind of a grassroots podcast. So if you know of other lawyers that might benefit from this from these messages or these interviews, you know, please feel free to pass it along. And certainly if you're a provider attorney that wants to take part in our services, our website's unbundledattorney.com. We'd be happy to speak with you and see if we have a great fit to work together. So with that, we will see you all on the next episode. Thanks again. For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.